Hey guys, and welcome back to the H1 podcast. Today we're very lucky to have on a good mate of mine and a fellow GT superstar, Jordan Pepper, all the way from, I think you're in Barcelona at the moment, right?
Yeah.
Exactly, cool. Just out there at the moment, South African based, and yeah, let's have a quick chat with him. How's it going, mate?
Yeah, all good. Thanks for having me, guys. Obviously, you guys all got your busy schedules, and I think it's the same for everyone now that the season's finally getting underway. So it's the same as last year, but at least things are getting going, which is good. And yeah
exactly right.
Really excited to speak some bullshit for an hour or so.
Yeah, of course. Well, obviously now you've met Jake and Alex via Zoom, so we've got plenty to talk to you about. First off, how are you doing? How's lockdown been treating you out? Obviously, you're usually based in Germany, and what are you up to at the moment?
Yeah, so it's been good actually. Normally, obviously, we start the season off with Bathurst every year, and I'm kind of glad in a way that it got cancelled, because I don't think I would have been driving there this season, because obviously, as it's all changed for me a little bit. But you know, it's been good. Had my first race of the year already, which is always good to get done. And then kind of been back in Germany in lockdown, bad weather, lack of motivation to keep training and stuff. But you know, everything's picking up now, and the weather's getting a bit warmer and stuff like that. And yeah, it's been settled in again with the VDL brothers. Obviously, we all three live together, so that's always exciting. And no, it's just been pretty good. And yeah, obviously, it's one of those things now. It's not going to be the busiest year for me, but it's just piecing together everything, you know, going forward.
Yeah, well, at least you've done a race, mate. I'm stuck in a hotel room. I'm stuck in a hotel room just waiting for someone to get COVID, basically.
I'm not envying you. I couldn't imagine how tough that must be, you know. But I've been grateful, you know. It's one of those things. I think it's not common knowledge anyways through the chat, you know, that Bentley obviously stopped. And I think Seb was your first guest, and I think he had a great explanation of everything there. And you know, it's one of those things, but I'm just grateful I managed to find something, and super grateful for those who've supported me and stuff like that. And you know, it's tough. I think for everything to happen and the way timing is going on, you know, and if you look in the whole grand scheme of things with endurance racing, with sports cars, it comes in waves with like the big factory involvements in the certain disciplines, and they slowly fade away. Customer teams are like pulling it all together, and then the next wave comes, and to have COVID on top of the end of one wave is kind of like the impact is double as harsh, you know. So I think that makes it tough for any driver, you know, to secure a proper full-time program. But like you say, Jake, you just got to hang out there, wait. And I think all of us just doing what we can, you know, at the end of the day, it's down to any opportunity. And I'm trying to take every opportunity I can at the moment.
Yeah, I definitely think that's the key, isn't it? It's almost a bit of just survival of the fittest at the minute with COVID. But where was your first race of the year, Jordan?
So obviously this season I'm competing in GT World Challenge America. I drove with the team last year when I was a Bentley factory driver in Europe in GT World Challenge Endurance, and they've decided to switch away, obviously, since Bentley stopped their program for the future. The cars are still homologated for one more year, but they decided to take the opportunity to change brands. And being a private driver and free on the market, really, it was the perfect opportunity for me to switch with them. It's a new challenge, you know. Obviously, I did put it out there to try find a factory deal, but end of November, beginning of December is not the right time to be dropped from one brand to try find something else at another. So, you know, it was an incredible team, and I had a good season and built great relationships with them when I was supporting them as a factory driver from Bentley. So it was seemed pretty good to pick up that relationship and move on. And luckily enough, the team had the means to do so, and they needed to have one pro driver minimum with them. Lambo wasn't going to supply them all with factory drivers, which is rightly so. And you know, it's a new challenge. Racing in America is pretty cool. It's my first real full-time experience. Tracks are old school, like South Africa and the UK. I think it's the three nations where the tracks are old school. There's none of this track limit bullshit, which I love. And it's been nice, good. We got off to a mega start, leading the championship, double pole. Was great to also secure, like, show to myself that I'm not just a hacker in a big powered Bentley. I didn't, not too bad. I got lots to learn with the Lambo and the change. It's so different, but I'm glad it's almost complete polar opposites, you know. It just makes life easier. And yeah, then a big break, and then we get back to it beginning of May, and then I think from there on it's a little bit more once a month type of thing, you know. So
don't worry, you could be a hacker in a BMW like Nick, but
he doesn't hack too bad, to be honest. I raced against him last year in GT Masters.
Yeah,
we're always together, yeah, at the back of the field, because the tracks are first, second gear dominant, and between the Bentley and the BMW, we just stood still with it in those types of tracks. But yeah, we actually had a fun laugh at Oschersleben at the final round. I think we were both frustrated but you know, it was 2-3 degrees. We couldn't get temperature in the front tires, so we both qualified somewhere near the back, and you can't pass there. So we basically took turns and gave each other chances to try attack the front. But I was indicating to let Nick by, and then he really? Went by. He tried to overtake, and yeah, because anyways, it's a crash derby when you're at the back there. So we tried to make the best of it. So
I'm surprised, yeah, those two cars.
That was really,
those two cars are massive though. Like, they're built like a fridge.
They're big girls, they are pretty big. But when you put them on the real tracks like Spa, Silverstone, Bathurst, all that, they do perform really well. You can't knock them for what they are, you know. And at the end of the day, to take what they started off at as a road car and compete against the other brands is pretty impressive. So got nothing bad to say there. It's just, it's kind of when you're racing in championships that were pushed back due to COVID, and half the tracks are all first, second gear corners, 3 degrees track temperature. You can't get tire temperature like the mid-engine cars and stuff. And we just struggled. And we're probably, it's one of the most competitive championships anyway. So you were only like half a second off and you P nowhere, P last in quali.
Yeah, it's a rough old. That was a really funny event as well. Like you say, we started, I think there was a first lap crash anyway. So then we restarted again. And then I could see Jordan had started to struggle. And actually, we were faster in a straight line at BMW for that race, which is, yeah, a bit unusual. Usually we're quite similar. So he indicated, I went through, and then I had a go. And then we were so close, we were stuck behind. And eventually, I think we got one of the other cars pitted. And I think we both did 2 qualifying lap style laps. Actually, my teammate came out in 11th or something like that. But your teammate had a shocker on the pit exit or something, didn't he?
Yeah.
So we gained a load of time. But
yeah. But to be honest, it was a tough old year, to say the least.
So we'll swing back round to you two racing and GT Masters and all that shenanigans. But let's go back to the very start, Jordan. And like, how did you get involved with racing, and how did it all begin for you?
Yeah, so I think there's two types of stories that everyone really has, and they either get in super young, and that's the case for me, or I've listened to you guys now. You got in quite late as well, most of you. So with me, I was basically in motorsport from the moment I can remember. It started off just supporting my dad racing and my sister. I've got an older sister who races as well. And I basically started off supporting them. And as soon as I was old enough to sit inside a go-kart, my dad bought me one. And then as soon as I could reach the pedals, I was allowed to race basically. So it started when I was 4 or 5. And just one thing that I can give credit to my family, which was, I look back at it and I think it was super tough times in terms of like why I wasn't winning really championships and stuff. But what was good for them is they put in the effort. Like my dad put in 100% effort, and the rest of my family, when I wanted to put in 100% effort, and there was no forcing factor on me, you know, they didn't want to try and make me the next great superstar. They wanted me to race because I wanted to race. So sometimes I didn't ever go testing because I wanted to go play a hockey match or a cricket match, and they allowed me to be active in a lot of sports, you know. So we didn't take it that seriously. I took it serious enough to compete at the top end, and I felt we took it like always had the best equipment possible and stuff like that, which is good. But I worked through the ranks of South African karting and then started to get the touch of the international scenes when you qualified for like the world finals of certain categories. And like Vortex Rock was a big thing in South Africa, so we always used to go to the NATO for the international final and had some really good success there. And it was kind of like I would finish behind a few South Africans at home, and then when we would go to a level playing field, I'd beat them. And then I thought, hang on a minute, you know, I can actually do it when I go back home, you know. And that kind of kicked me a bit, you know. We took it a bit more serious then. And then I think I turned around to my dad, and I basically was also involved in radio control model aeroplane flying, precision aerobatics, and was pretty good at it. And you had to take that sport way more serious than you have to take motorsports. So I used to spend a lot of my time doing that and other sports and stuff like that. And then I said to my dad, like he said, you got to choose now, because the next step's going to be a lot more costly in motorsport. And the next step also for anything else, he says, you have to choose. And I said, okay, yeah, let's take racing seriously then. And for sure, it was a good passion of mine. Also, golf at that time was something that I picked up, and it really helped my racing. You know, it really helped get my head straight around things, to focus and to commit to things, and to also get over bad times. And that's when I realized, okay, racing's the thing forward. And we kind of took the approach that we're never going to make the F1 dream, coming from so far away, a land unknown, basically. It was big in the olden days for all the factory racing, but also touring car based back then. And the last time Formula One was in South Africa, I think, was 1993 for a test, and that was it. And even before that was racing. So the dream was way too far fetched. And I never sat in a single seat in my life, actually, and went the same route that the Calvin and Sheldon did. There's an awesome one make championship back home, supported by VW. Did 1 year of that, finished third. Calvin actually won it that year. I started like half a season behind him. So he kind of had like a little bit of a head start. And in the championship, I just crashed into everyone the first half of the year. So I had no chance, and then cleaned it up, and then moved to Europe when I was 15, still traveling backwards and forwards, doing school and stuff like that. Raced Soroka R Cup. The first year finished third, second year managed to win it, and got great support from Volkswagen to move into GTs, and been there ever since, really.
Yeah, so you said about, like, I think it's in quite, you know, like a stark and harsh comparison to the UK, because I imagine like Nick and Jake, who have both come from a, you know, almost you guys have not really considered going to that GT path early. You sort of, it was so natural for you two to go into single seaters.
Yeah. I mean, from mine and Nick's point of view, it's very, I can't speak for, you know, for Jordan, in the sense that I don't know what it's like in South Africa, but I'm just picturing what it's like. And I can't imagine there's the same choice and same sort of direction that you have from cadet karting all the way into, you know, Formula 4, Formula 3. It's kind of all laid out for you, really. It's just a community thing. If you have the money, you go and do it. It's like you go do casting, you go do international casting if you can, then you go into first step of car racing. I didn't hear anyone when I was, I didn't grow up karting, but when I was racing people in karting, I didn't hear anyone that wanted or realized that they had an option to go into GTs.
I think for me, it was somehow I ended up in GTs, but it wasn't the goal was always touring cars. Because touring cars was big in South Africa, and that's the thing. So we had the relatable international platform there, where our single-seater stuff, which is not looked at badly and it's just outdated, we had like Formula Fords, like the old Juratex and Z-Tex and stuff like that, that I'm sure were around. They were very big in the like mid, early 2000s in the UK as well, you know, but even in the 90s, and anyone who went to win the Formula Ford Festival went to race F3 and then went to F1 type of thing. But South Africa just didn't have that next platform. So they didn't have the step into the single seater range. And it's like, yeah, we had to see. And also my dad was always involved in touring cars in South Africa. He did race single seaters in the beginning of his kind of career. But he was always involved in touring cars. And we just said, like, we're going to try and make a career out of it. And, you know, everyone's dream is F1, and it's hard to, as a 15-year-old, to say, I'm probably never going to make it, you know, but DTM World Touring Cars, British Touring Cars, all of that at that time was like, that's a goal. I can go there. I've ended up in GTs because GT, I think, went from an amateur status to a really good professional platform, which is incredible to see. And that's why it gave the opportunity to end up there. And it's taken a step above, I would say, well, at least in a certain way, World Touring Cars and all that, you know, it's really got a prestigious platform. But it's crazy to think, you know, because the option was there. But when you're fighting with a currency that's weak against the UK, like we did look at going to the UK and try, it was a considered, but, you know, it's one of those things where we just thought we stick to what we know, and that's probably going to give us our best opportunity. And touring cars is what we knew, you know.
No, sure. And how, I mean, what did your dad race in, mate? Because we haven't actually talked about that.
Yeah, so actually, yeah, the racing goes back to my granddad, who's from the UK, actually, and he moved out to South Africa, and he raced, like, motocross, just all club racing and motocross and that type of thing. And that's what I think brought the passion to my dad. And then my dad was racing motocross professionally because it was really big in South Africa at the time for different, like, couple of the big brands. And then he broke his back and kind of at the point where he made his breakthrough. And then he came back to it and just said, you know what, it's too dangerous. I think at that time they just had my sister, actually. And he said he's going to give car racing. Well, I don't know. I think it was before that, to be honest. He's going to give car racing a go. And my granddad is really, like, passionate about, like, all mechanic side of things. And they, just the two of them, you know, they kind of ventured into car racing, Formula V, Formula GTI, which is basically, it was a F3. It was just basically a Volkswagen F3 back then. They had a one-make class. And then he did one race of Formula 3000. And then ultimately, you know, he stepped in for, similar to where you're at, Jake, to be honest. Someone got sick or injured, and then my dad was just there, and they were racing in South Africa, and he got the call up, and it almost presented a great opportunity for him. And then basically, he just couldn't get the funding together to race in Europe. And at that time, British, like, Formula 3000 was an option, but then the championship stopped. So he kind of went back into, that's when he started his touring car thing, and that's when Volkswagen launched this one make championship, which is still existing today, surprisingly, still based off a VW Polo, which is so successful. And he just went into that, and he's such a good people's person, you know. So he was able to make a living out of the amateur series as a, along with his sideline business, but, you know, attract way more sponsorship than he needed to. He could work on the cars himself, and I think he's one of the most successful, like, racing drivers in South Africa to win the least amount of South African titles. I mean, he finished second about 10 or 15 or 20 times. I don't know, something in his career, like a crazy amount, but only won like one or two championships. But it's cool, you know, like, I always look up to him, and he still kicks my ass. We sometimes drive cars back to back, and he's pretty quick, even though he's 58 years old. So he's really fast and handy, and always willing to call me out when I do shit and stuff like that, which is good to have a good team.
I
was just gonna say, well, you know, something that you touched on earlier that you know, is quite different to a lot of guys that come into, or girls even that come into it, you sounded like you had quite a lot of options in terms of what you wanted to do when you were growing up, and when you actually finally had to decide to choose motorsport. I mean, you named what, golf, what else did you named?
Radio control, but that's not a career, to be honest.
It takes some time,
and you can actually, it's funny, like, it was crazy because it was like everything that I focused on. But yeah, exactly. I think, I don't know what it was. I don't know, I can't pinpoint it. I think when you grow up as a like, your parents are so influential in everything you do, and anything you do when they support you kind of becomes natural, and that's what you think. And I can't look back and say why they did certain things, but I can look back and be grateful for it, because I think you get a lot of people, and I think at times in my racing career there was a lot more guys in South Africa who were talented, but I felt they burnt out and then they turned to other things, or whether they burnt out or ran out of money because of spending too much in the earlier part of their career, or I don't know what it is, but they're not racing anymore. And I kind of feel that when it was time to take things seriously, although I was involved in a lot of sports for a long period of time, I never felt like I burnt out to the point when it was time to take things seriously. I felt that was the time that I had 110% motivation to put into it. I feel for some kids actually who almost get, they hammered with just testing. Yeah, you get the guys who are making to F1 and it's incredible to see and hear. But like, how, like the way they get burnt out, like you, there's so many guys chasing that one dream of Formula One and they might get burnt out. And I feel for them because they're never, like I fell in love with the sport before I took it seriously. Take it seriously. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
I took it seriously because I fell in love with it, you know?
What age did you like fully think, what age was that question your dad gave you? What, do you want to continue in motorsport? What age was that?
I think it was it was 2009, 2010. So it's, how old was I? 14 then? It was like my last year of karting. 2011 was my last year of karting, but it was actually a year. I literally just didn't have a license. I wasn't old enough to race cars. And we were fed up with our governing body who didn't give us a license because of an age thing. Like Calvin, for example, with the same year, he's a month older than me. He could start 2011 and I couldn't because they put the rule in middle of the year and he's born in June, I'm in July. So I had to start 2012 for cars. So we're fed up with them. So we're like, we don't want to support their karting because they're like, yeah, you should stay in karting, try win a championship. And I said, it's going to mean nothing to me. So we had a deal to race Rotax in Europe. But it was before that, basically, where I said to my dad, he's like, okay, this is the time now. We take this last year of karting 2010 seriously, and then we're taking cars seriously from there onwards, you know? Mm-hmm. And yeah, that was kind of the point. But that's also the point where I realized, like, that's where I stopped a lot of the other sports that I did. I used to swim. I was horrendous at it. I used to play hockey, not too bad, but just played it because it was a nice team sport. Cricket also played. I wasn't going to be a cricketer. I just enjoyed the sport. Golf I was pretty handy on, but I think living on a golf course and growing up on a golf course and using playing every day instead of doing my schoolwork was what made that good. but yeah, if there was two sports, it would have been between golf and racing. But at the time, I didn't have the mind for golf, I don't think.
It's quite interesting the point.
It's
quite interesting the point you made about you know, like people getting burnt out or whether they just, you know, spent the money too early or whatever. Because it's when you were saying that, I kind of thought about even my own story in a way, because I started when I was just about to turn 16. And we had money enough, you know, middle class, we had enough to live absolutely comfortably, and we had enough to get into karting in the first place and go into the first steps of car racing, which isn't cheap, but it's nowhere near as expensive as the later levels. But I actually think if I'd started earlier, we would have struggled by the time I came to the age of 16 to jump into cars. And I don't think I would have been able to make it. And I was just sat there pondering about that as you sort of made that point. It's quite an interesting one.
Yeah. And I think at the time also, what made it also a little bit different for me was having an older sister she's 6 years older than me. So she was in the sport for, I don't know, 4 or 5 years. She's always been ahead of me, you know, and she is really good. And throughout karting, she was incredibly good and stuff. And she was fortunate enough from a young age to be backed by a lot of like development, like teams and stuff within South Africa, which was paying a lot of motorsport. But then for a period, like my family had to obviously come up with some money and stuff to support. And it was kind of a seen thing. Like she's the racer in the family. Like she's the one who's going to be professional. Yeah. I'm just doing it because I enjoy it. So I took a back step on it. We never did anything bad. Like I was very lucky and fortunate enough that every year we rolled out with new material. So I always used to have a new chassis every year for karting, and I didn't have 10 engines, but I had a practice engine and a race engine and that type of thing. And instead of going testing every weekend, we went maybe once a month, you know, if we weren't racing. And so it's not like I took it unprofessionally. And when it was time to put new tires on, we did. But I can 100% see how we could have spent double, triple the budget to maybe have one or two more titles on my CV. But I don't know if that would have made a difference, because it wouldn't have got me to F1. No. It definitely wouldn't have got me to F1. And I don't know, because car racing, karting, you learn so much, and I almost feel like one of my strengths these days is being like a good racer. And I feel like it was kind of help trying to like always have to fight when it came to kind of being a bit unprepared, you know. I never won titles, but I don't look at it any bad way. And I'm actually like, I think I would be the person I am today based on, I would be a totally different person. I might not be in motorsport. I could be somewhere else, you know, but I'm here today because of what's happened. And I think I don't blame any, I can't say to my parents, you know, I could be a this or a that. And I think like, I'm just grateful for the opportunity that they gave me. And I think we did everything, at least what we thought was best to our best ability, you know?
Yeah, because like, as you know, as we, I think, so I started taking racing more seriously around, I think it was around 14, 15, the same age. And I know Nick did as well. And I was going to ask Nick, actually, do you think like starting later almost gives you a bit of an advantage because you're a bit more mature and you sort of know what's going on a bit more? Do you think that helps the learning process almost speed up?
Yeah, I do, mate. I was going to actually, yeah. I think we've been speaking behind the screens a little bit. My connection's really bad, just so everyone knows. So if I am stuttering and whatnot, you know what. But yeah, actually, simply because we felt that people that had been good at other sports beforehand had then been good or better prepared when coming into the sport. So when Jordan mentioned he'd played golf and done other sports before, I think it's a really good thing to be able to have done, or had the, you know, the premise to have done that before you jump in. So in my case, I'd played golf quite handily as well until like 13, 14, and the racing thing. Yeah, you're just competing.
I think, have we lost him?
We're struggling with Nick.
Yeah, big time, mate.
Tesco connection.
We'll have to get Fats on the job today. You know, he's going to earn his money, isn't he, with the editor?
Yeah, he's going to have to. He's going to have to. I might even jump on my 3G.
Oof, you know, it's bad when that happens. But I have to agree. Like, I think, yeah, there's some, like, some of my mates have played, you know, have played football to a high level or done athletics to a really high level, or, and you see the transfer, they get on the bike and you can just see that they have that, the head for just knuckling down and getting and pushing to the limits and pushing forward. But I'm going to move on to like a question we asked Sheldon, because big difference in culture between Europe and South Africa. So how did you find the move over here, over to the top side of the globe?
Honestly, it was difficult. There's no word of a lie. You know, when we committed to racing Scirocco Cup, we kind of said, okay, we got, my dad says we can put together so much budget. The championship was quite fixed. It was 50,000 euros per year to do it and plus crash damage. But we kind of said we're going to try to keep our noses as clean as possible. And you want a bit of prize money like for races and stuff like that. And we said, as long as the crash damage doesn't outweigh the prize money we win, that's fine. And also, if you're crashing too much, you're not going to win anything anyway. So we said, my dad gave me 2 years, which I was really grateful for. We got a good sponsor to support and cover like half the budget, which was good. And then I was really lucky enough to win the championship and get, like, it was the final year, and Volkswagen supported me with enough money to go into GT racing. But we had it for one season, and my dad said, honestly, we're kind of going, when we run out of money, that's it. Like, and I said to my dad, that's fair, because my family built up a nice lifestyle in South Africa and I wasn't going to ruin it for them. You know, I think at that point I was old enough to realize that it's this passion and this dream and this realism. It's savage. I think motorsport and growing up, when you get exposed to the real world, you can't, like, you need the dream behind it. But when you get exposed to it, you also need to be realistic. And it was a clear statement I said to my parents. I don't know if they would have followed through. Maybe they would have fought harder. But luckily enough, I went in with the mindset to say, when I go to Europe, it's make or break. You know, I'm going to hustle whichever way I can. And the first year was really tough because I moved to a foreign country, couldn't speak the language. I was bad in languages in school growing up. So I felt couldn't couldn't really learn it. I worked with the team, or sort of the deal we did there, that I kind of helped around. So I used to clean like the cars, and when they came back from tests and races, and help the mechanics and stuff like that. It was just the deal that I had with them, and worked there full time. So I was in there every day training and stuff like that. And at the same time, Calvin was driving for the team, but in a different position. He was a year ahead, and it was his first year as a factory driver. So we were on two sides of the scale. You know, I was trying to be where he was. And at the same time, me and Calvin, imagine two guys same age coming from a country that's far away. You kind of think you're fighting for one spot, which you are. You know, you always got that one rival. We were very good mates in karting before, but when it was time to take it seriously, we knew we had to fight against each other. And I think that pushed us to greater heights. But we ended up moving to the same town, racing for the same team. And although we were mates, we were not close, you know. So you kind of, although we were there together, we felt like we were in a country alone. And fortunate enough, we got over our differences. And I think that's what made the step a lot easier, you know. And at that time, Sheldon also moved shortly after to Europe. And although those first years were tough, you know, it taught me like it's fight or flight. And that was great. You know, I had a bad first season, but I didn't let it get to me, in a sense that I gave it everything, and the team saw that, and they kind of helped me put together a program the year after. And that was my introduction to Bentley, where they took over the factory program for GT Masters with Bentley. And I drove with an amateur who kind of, in Pro-Am, we were the only actually Pro-Am car, and he funded everything really. So it was a great deal. And I helped him obviously, and we had some cool results and stuff, and it was personally really good. And that took me to the link to with Bentley. And also, you know, I still stayed in Germany because I felt at that time me, Sheldon, and Calvin formed a great relationship together. And I'm so glad like that happened. You know, I'm glad that we got put in a foreign environment as two adults to sort our own life out, you know, and that's what made us get along so well, which was incredible, you know. And Europe's not that bad, to be honest. I enjoy it. It's great. Racing's amazing. The level is unreal. Not saying that South Africa's level's bad. I think the fact that there's three or four of us over, or the three like most well known is myself, Sheldon, and Calvin over here fighting at the front. But I think we have a mentality in South Africa that you just fight for whatever you want. And I think that's helped us a long way. And, you know, like to race against the depth in Europe has been incredible and eye-opening, and made so many good mates along the way. So I wouldn't change it, you know.
How cool.
I'm glad the 15-year-old kid like followed through on his dream, which is awesome.
And how cool was it, like finally getting that sort of big break, let's say, with Bentley? Like when you got the phone call or email or whatever it was, text.
It's a funny story, to be honest. I kind of had the break, then got it taken away from me, and then got it again. And
how did that happen?
So basically, a little bit of a background story. Obviously, Bentley is a smaller brand, and as you may know, in endurance racing, like Europe as a whole is a big market. The world is a big market. And if you look at GT3, you've got IGCC, which is like the world kind of thing. GT World Challenge Europe covers Europe. And in Germany is a big car market. And that's where Nürburgring and GT Masters, their championship, actually is two big players. And Bentley had kind of two factories. Well, they had their main factory team, which was M Sport. But then they also supported Apt Sportsline when they had a contract for Europe, for Germany, sorry, to do Nürburgring.
Apt have a Bentley program.
They had, yes.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, so it's from 2016 and just 2 years, actually, 2016, 2017.
Oh, cool.
So because I drove for Apt in 15 in an Audi, they kind of got me into the program, but not as any link to any, like I said, with an amateur. And I proved myself, and that kind of got me the first big break, where I drove with that, signed my first professional contract. It was pretty cool to start negotiating money to get paid is always the step you want to take.
That's a great feeling, isn't it?
Yeah, it wasn't a lot of money, but to me it was a lot, you know, which was incredible. And I did that for 2017, and I was so grateful for that. App gave me that first opportunity. They trusted in me early on, and they convinced Bentley that, you know, because I was still a young kid then, you know, and they convinced Bentley that I am ready to take on the challenge of Nürburgring, and which was awesome. And was kind of a tough one. You hope that your first big break, you have a great result, and ultimately went out the pits on my first. So I went out the pits, like out lap, first lap of the race. Nick Schriedenkreutz, my right rear wheel fell off. So only flat sixth gear left hander. You don't want your right rear wheel to depart, and it did. Luckily, somehow it lodged in the disc, and then I managed to meet the team. Actually, met me halfway around the track in one of the exits. But that's the crazy thing about the race, you know. And they changed it, and I pulled away, and I just got lapped. So we're only one lap down, like super lucky. We thought, okay, we're still in it. Came into the pits to just, they changed the suspension in like, I think 3 minutes, the whole right side. It was incredible to go out and have an ABS failure that wasn't picked up. And it was a problem we struggled with all weekend. And I braked for turn one, and there was no brakes, no warning, no anything, straight into the wall. So that was it. And I was like, fucking hell. Like, how bad can it be, you know? Yeah. The first big break, I went through all the build-up races, everything perfect, never did a thing wrong. And the one that counts, I've had a wheel fall off and I've put it in the wall. And I'm like, what? That's it, career done. Then the team, like, they knew it wasn't my fault. Bentley knew it wasn't my fault. And they put a third car in for Spa that year. And it was kind of like my second chance, you know? And did an amazing performance, made top 20 quali, like out-qualified the full-time factory drivers on the M-Sport cars, which was good. Personal performances in the race, mega. But the sad part was App's program came to an end then. You know, I think there was too much political things between behind the scenes. And but Bentley said, look, for 2018, we want you. You know, if one of our drivers who's was Oliver Jarvis at the time, and actually funny story, he's now manages me. we just newly started, which was a really good relationship. I get on really well with him, and if he was going to stop with Bentley, I would be put in. And I only drove until July, and then I had nothing on, but I had that in the back of my mind, the new car coming. They planned me for development testing with them, and they said, if Oliver stays, when Guy Smith retires end of 18 or middle of 18 or whatever, you'll be in then. So it was basically just a matter of time. They trusted me, whatever. But on the flight, on the way to the one endurance test, I get a phone call, literally just as we're on like taxing back, from Matt Wilson. And he's like, look, I know you're coming over to the test, but you can turn around if you want to based on the news I'm going to give you. And I'm like, what's going on? Said, we've been kind of given the opportunity to sign Jules Gounon at the time, and we didn't want to miss out on it. And that's after the year that he had. He was really quick in G2L Challenge Europe. He just won ADAC GD Masters. So he was kind of a hot property at the time. And they said, we've signed him. We've signed the deal. Like, we just signed the deal, so there's no seat for you. And I was like, well, Matt, I'm actually literally on the way. I can't get off the plane, so I'm coming regardless, you know? And then I was left with nothing, and they still wanted to keep the relationship. I had nothing. I was like, how shit can it be? You know, one opportunity fell away, got the next chance. That's gone away before I even had a chance to prove myself. And then two rounds into 2018 season, Guy Smith decided to retire. And then, yeah, that's when I got my first full-time break and didn't look back since, you know. And I was glad that the team still gave me that opportunity. It didn't come the way we planned, but, you know, at the end, things happened for a reason, and I had a great 2018, 19, and 20 season as a Bentley driver. And ultimately, the growth I took throughout those years, you know, I think I was like from where I started to where I ended up, I think I was so grateful for it. You know, I think your first factory gig and your first few years as a factory driver, although you think you're ready for the level, you know, there's still new factors that present themselves. And I definitely am grateful for the chance that they gave me. I'm sad it ended so early, because I think we had something so great and unique as a small brand fighting against the big dogs. But yeah, in the end, it was incredible. And yeah, like you asked, Jake, it was amazing to have that first break. And I think that's something that I push towards to having again. You know, that feeling and that satisfaction is incredible.
Yeah. So last year was a difficult year for a lot of brands, drivers, manufacturers, whatever, with COVID. Yeah. But we come to the end of last year, and and in last year, as you said, you know, your final year as a Bentley driver. So can you like talk to us about like what happened with Bentley coming to an end? I know if listeners go back, you can hear Seb's take on things. And as you said, he put it so eloquently. So it'd be good to hear your side of it, mate. So
it's, you know, you can sit here and I can say how unfair it is and stuff like that, that you just get dropped in end of November and stuff like that by the program. But ultimately, going racing at a factory level is not down to just Bentley Motorsport. It wasn't down to just Bentley Motorsport. It wasn't down to myself. It's down to Bentley as a whole, you know. And ultimately, it kind of came at the right time, COVID, I think, for them to relook at things and see where they're spending money. And when a small brand like that, a luxury car brand, takes some heavy hits in the market, they have to look at cutting ties of things. And motorsport's a luxury at the end of the day, you know. It's a marketing tool, but it is a luxury. And when the whole world is also going on this EV train and this emissions, like, focus and drive, you know, of producing electric vehicles and stuff like that, to market something that's a V8 gas guzzling machine is no longer like fundable, you know. And I think also it's like doesn't make sense to them. So it went from the program being talked about middle of the year to and beginning of 2020 to growing, and the plans for the future were looking amazing. It's also why I had the opportunity in 2019 to switch for 2020 to another brand. I look back at it and go, I should have taken it. Not going to mention which brand, but it's definitely one that's...
Go on.
Nah, I can't. It's one of the big ones. And it's one of the ones that I think will stick around forever. But I chose Bentley for the right reasons. I enjoyed the smaller family environment of it. I enjoyed where I was at within the program. I think every driver within their own brand works to be up at the top of their brand. And, you know, and I think I found my role within Bentley and I started to become one of the more influential roles. And we went on to win Bathurst in 2020 and the package was all linking up, which makes it so sad because we formed something so great with the plan for a bigger future, you know, to grow it, to expand it, to look at other options. And not saying that those don't come back, but, you know, like stuff like LMDH, obviously, everyone mentioned and spoke about and all those type of things. And then to all of a sudden, everything getting pushed on, okay, we're going to start negotiating into, I don't know, I think it was like September or probably even earlier than that, August. Oh no, we have to wait for board meetings because then everything obviously needs to get approved. And it got pushed to the point where it was like something's fishy. And then you get it confirmed, okay, program's cut, it's done, you know? Mm. And that's when you're like, fuck, like what do I do now? Sorry for the bad language, but it's just the truth. And it sucks being a racing driver and it's such a shit place to be in. I wish no driver has to ever go through it because like, what do you do? Your life, you're dependent on it. It's like racing is our job. To be a professional racing driver is our job. It's not a luxury. It's not anything. At the end of the day, we do it to not only we do it because we love motorsport, but we do it to pay the bills at the end of the day. Mm. And it's like, what do you do? I'm done. Like, how am I going to make a living? How am I going to earn anything? Like, that's the first thing that goes through your mind. And it's just like, it's a shame because nobody needs to be dropped at the age of, I don't know, like I'm still young in the sport, but nobody also needs to be dropped at the end of November. No. And the timing was not like, it's not like they planned to do it. It's not like they held us on and just dropped. And it's also not like I got dropped because of poor performance. You know, I didn't see it coming, didn't see anything happening, but it's like, it doesn't make anything easier. You know, it's like, where do you go from there? And It's. I think the whole fact that last year got carried out as a late delayed season because of COVID didn't help the fact that we were getting dropped in November, you know?
Yeah.
I think COVID just makes it, you know, it compounds it even more, doesn't it? Because if motorsport was in a strong place, but it was just Bentley's problem on, you know, board level, you know, you would stand a much better chance right now of looking to get a seat elsewhere, keeping your ass in a seat. And it was just unfortunate because now the teams, customer teams or manufacturers, they don't have the same confidence, let alone money, in motorsport right now. And it's the same for the rest of the world, really.
Exactly. And I think a lot of us here can relate to that. And I hope that some people listening, also see that it's not the end of the world. You know, at the end of the day, I believe there's going to be big opportunities coming, and you can give up. And I've been through many tough times in my career already. So to give up now is pointless. And that's not what I did. You know, I picked up the phone straight away, and luckily I made some great links with people, and there was a lot of phone calls that went on. I spoke to a lot of different brands. I didn't reach out to everyone because I feel that's it's maybe the one thing to do. You can do it. But then, you know, I rather touch to people I knew and trusted and knew my ability. Mm-hmm. And yeah, managed to put together a great program in America. Super thankful for it because it's another opportunity in a great brand. Lamborghini's really incredible. And, you know, and in the future as well, I didn't end things on bad terms with Bentley. I love the brand, love driving for the people, and the people at Bentley Motorsport were really great to me to give me the break. And, you know, if there is something that comes back, and I really wish it, because I feel they got unfinished business in a way. I feel like we turned the corner and really started to have a great program and structure. And maybe it is in something else, but I still feel there's many passionate people within Bentley Motorsport that can do good. And if the opportunity were to present itself in a different championship to go back there, and it's the right thing for my career to do it, I'll do so happily. I didn't feel the need to slag them off in any way and say, how can you drop me? Yeah, I felt really sad or bad about it, but it's not the right reaction. You know, at the end of the day, it's ultimately beyond anyone else's decision. You know, like, COVID's bigger than anything else.
Yeah, and you don't want to burn bridges either. You know, not just that Bentley is a brand, but even like the people that work there, you don't know where they're going to turn up. They could change brands, and you get opportunities there.
I think in the sport, you're going to see the same faces 2-3 times. I've already seen some people twice round in my short career at totally different places in the world. You know, and it's like I think to burn bridges is the worst thing, and maybe that's the cool thing about being South African and being a bit laid back. I don't know. I don't really hold grudges against people. And, you know, I'm just grateful for where I am. And I think I got a great opportunity to grow now as a driver, a new challenge. And I think new challenges is always help. Yeah. I think they help motivate people. And I'm still 24, so I've got a long way ahead of me.
From going from November to now, and, you know, you've already done your first race, you know, that's quite a turnaround. But for people listening, deals are done way before November.
Yeah,
exactly. Every manufacturer I reached out to was we'd love to have you, but let's pick up conversations next year again. And then we picked up, there's certain things, and Nick knows it, races like Nürburgring 24 Hour present themselves with one-off opportunities with manufacturers and stuff like that. So I had a lot of talk and focus on those areas. And ultimately, I had a deal for that as well. Just as things were starting to look great again, had a deal for that. And then it came to an end because calendars got moved around for COVID and I have a clash. So had to put that to bed. And there was a few other opportunities where calendars clashed. So yeah, my program's limited, but the goal is anyway still to be back at a factory level, factory driver status. And I think I'm not going to stop till I get there, no matter where.
Lamborghini is quite an interesting one for me, because, you know, it's such an iconic brand, and it's, you know, it does GT racing, and it has its one mate championships with Super Trofeo. But it's one of the brands I don't know a lot about in motorsport. You know, the car looks cool because they're all the road, every Lamborghini looks cool.
Everyone knows what a Lamborghini is.
Yeah, exactly. But I don't know what the motorsport side of it's like. I mean, obviously you're racing for the customer team and just their customer team in one of their cars, but how does the manufacturer team work? Is there an opportunity maybe to impress and get there somewhere? Do they have a factory roster?
Yeah, so obviously they got quite a few fair few factory drivers. I think most brands within GT3 at the minute have, I'd say, anywhere between 6 to 12 people, Nick. I don't know if you can, if you agree.
Yeah, that would be about
somewhere
right.
around that range, depending on the brand. And obviously, the more, the way GD3 is focused is customer racing first and foremost. But if a manufacturer has enough customers out there, they have enough money also to put back into factory level racing. Mm. And I think that allows for a lot more. So factory drivers get farmed out to customers to drive with and support, which I also had to do a lot of, obviously, when I was linked with Bentley. And at the same time, the same way it goes, because like my teammate is Andrea Caldarelli, who's one of Lambo's top factory drivers. And in the sister car, again, they got another full factory driver and then also like a supported factory driver, like from an American driver as well. And I think there is an opportunity. I haven't had any chats with anyone because I think it's too early to tell. I think at the end of the day, you got to see how the relationship builds within the brand. You know, I'm kind of also driving and contracted to the team as the team's pro driver. So I don't want to be approaching Lambo before I've even done any, you know, I don't want to go behind the team in any way. And I need to see which best way to approach it. But 100%, I think is a goal out there because I will be in a Lamborghini most of the time this year. And it's the best reference I have, you know, to where my level's at. And at the end of the day, I just need to give 110%, work really well. And I think it's also helpful to have a factory driver as my teammate, you know, and I'll work with him and stuff like that. Obviously two pros, but he's linked with the brand. And I think his word or value will hold a lot of emphasis, you know. At the end of the day, it was the same with me. I got asked a lot about drivers who I drove with, what I think of them, because raw speed's one thing, but the way they fit into environments and work and stuff. And ultimately the goal right now is to do the best I can for KPAX as well as Lamborghini in the seat I am at. And if the performance is there and the possibility to push for something to, like I said, my goal is 100% to be linked with a brand, and whether it be with Lamborghini, whether it be with another brand, I don't know. But I think the only thing I can do is let my driving talk for me at the minute. And there's no better way to say something than to just do it on track, you know.
You've got, as you said, you've got a full factory teammate, so you've got the best reference possible.
And the team's supported by Lamborghini in a strong way, and that's reference with the team, with the, like, a lot of factory like engineers and drivers there. So yeah. it's a great link, and I'm so grateful for it, you know. I was lucky enough, but I'm sure it was based, obviously, I knew the team from previous years, and it was not that they felt sorry for me that I had no drive. They wanted me regardless. Like, they approached me even before they knew I was with or with, not with Bentley onwards, you know. So I'm grateful for that.
And we spoke about, you know, touring car being a massive, you know, goal in South Africa to reach. Yeah. Do you see a future in GTs or possibly something else?
Now that I've been exposed to the endurance racing side of things, I love it. It's incredible. Jake, I think I heard you. You're saying you want to, like, maybe look into GT and stuff. And I guess once you get your first experience and see it, you're either going to love or hate it in endurance racing. Nick, I don't know where you feel about it, but personally, I love it. I think the goalpost has changed a lot because I love the dynamic of working with teammates and I enjoy that side of thing. You know, you learn so much off each other and I enjoy that. But touring car, somehow I still always think about it. Like, it crosses my mind. Like, is there unfinished business? There's a cool World Touring Car Championship now, obviously, with TCR cars. They're not GD3 cars. They're not at that level, but they still cool, that sprint racing, door banging style. Definitely something I want to have a go at. I really considered it over the winter, but when I signed the deal with KPAX, just calendar clashes put a stop to me approaching anything there seriously. So maybe I'll give it a go. I don't know. I'm always interested in Dakar, maybe in the near future.
Extreme E
looks mega. Yep, that was pretty cool. I enjoyed watching that.
Did you see that crash?
Yeah, it was the crash. There was about four, mate. It looked pretty impressive.
There was one where they were just going in a straight line and it just started barrel rolling.
Yeah, it looks pretty cool. And I think that side of it comes from the fact that I enjoy, like, over the winters and stuff, I enjoy going back to South Africa and riding a lot of motocross, enduro and stuff like that, and getting on two wheels. That's Alex, I think that's more your forte, isn't it?
That's way up my street, that. And
I begged my mom to let me race bikes, but she's not having it. She told my dad, if I race bikes, she's divorcing him. But when I turned 18, my mom's like, you know, you're old enough. If you want to go do it. You know, my dad, after he retired, I don't know, like 10 years back, 12 years back. And then he picked up bikes again because he couldn't do nothing. So he started into the enduro scene, back to his motocross roots. And man, I'm probably the biggest hacker out there, but I feel like Ken Roczen on a Saturday night supercross when I attack the track.
I know. I think my mum begged me to get into cars. It's, you know, it's the safer option. But the Extreme E was good, and you know, I do have a lot in common with them with crashing in straight lines. But we'll try and, you know, we're going to do a bit more of that this year. But I think we're going to wrap it up there, boys. Jordan, you know, thanks for coming on. I think what we'll do is we'll get you back on at the end of the year when we have your exclusive factory deal sorted.
And we
can announce that to everyone.
Well, then we could have two factory Lamborghini drivers back on, because Jack started racing with a Lamborghini, hasn't he?
Yeah.
Man, there's so many guys. That's the thing now. I'm on the side where I'm chasing all the factory driver's seats, you know. So maybe I'm after Nick's. Who knows? No, I'm joking.
Oh dear.
You know, at the end of the day, it's been a pleasure to chat to you guys, obviously. And at the end of the day with my career, I don't know where it's going to take me. But all I do know is that motorsport is a place I want to be involved in somewhere or not. I don't know. Maybe I go into the whole fighting for the driver's side of things a lot more, where one day I become like start my own, I don't know, union or something for drivers to get treated fairly. Because I've been through it, and I know a lot of people have been through a lot of horrible situations where you think you wish someone was supporting them. But at the end of the day, we want small piece in a big, large environment. Yeah. And been lucky enough to be linked to a factory, and I think and be a professional and make a living out of the sport. So maybe one day I can also give back to the sport and make it my own as well. So
I think just keep believing in your ability, mate. You'll be fine. Yeah.
100%. So thanks, Jordan, for coming on, and as Clarkson would say, on Top Gear, and you taking Nick's seat at BMW on that bombshell. But
mate, I'm honestly joking. Honestly,
it's going all
it's
over.
It's a highlight. 100%.
That's the clickbait. That is the clips.
Yeah.
On that bombshell.
On that bombshell. But hopefully Nick has a better connection that next time, so we can hear from him a bit more as well.
I just heard he's going to bigger, better things. You know.
He's off to Germany.
Maybe Nick, we go play golf together. I don't know.
We find two
different tours, and one caddies 1 week and one plays the next, and then we switch it up.
I'm up for it.
Oh, we should get a video of that on the channel.
Yeah, we'll definitely see a video out of that. But cheers, Jordan, for coming on, and make sure you follow Jordan on social media at Jordan Pepper. And you can find us back here next Wednesday for another podcast. But make sure you leave a like, a comment, rate it. Share it to your friends. Get us out
subscribe.
There. Exactly, on the YouTube. Subscribe. Like.
The next big thing, you're taking over all the Formula One podcasts and beyond the grid. So, to be honest, it's been great to listen to all your stuff, guys. It's nice to hear from every driver, and I'm glad we've always spoken about doing a podcast, but I'm glad someone's actually done it and getting involved in our scene. So. Mega job what you guys are doing. I'm sure it's not easy to find the time and do all the editing. And Fatula, good guy.
It's tough, you know, the editing. It's tough.
Yeah.
I don't know how I'd do it. I don't know how I fit it in.
Jake really struggles with it. But massive. No, I think as this is our 10th recording, I think we've got to give a big shout out to Fats for all the hard work.
He's been very much so.
You don't see
mega job, guys.
Fats, stand up. Where are you?
Fats, stand up in the background.
Show the wave.
People listening on Spotify will know what the hell's going on.
Yeah, they'll be thinking what's going on. But cheers, boys, and we'll catch you soon.
Thanks, guys.
Cheers, guys.
Have a good one, Jake. Enjoy that cold pizza, mate.
I didn't have pizza.